This is Bob Edwards Weekend. 2008 is not a good year for Labor Day. Employers have been cutting jobs for months, leading to a high unemployment rate. In certain sectors, like construction, the picture is especially bleak. But times are tough even for those who have jobs. The threat of the sagging economy is enough to convince most workers they should put up with forced overtime, working off the clock, unsafe conditions, and meager health insurance. Stephen Greenhouse writes about labor and workplace issues for the New York Times. He's only been on that beat for about 13 years, but he's already seen feast and famine.
In the late 90s, you remember, the American economy was doing extremely well. There was the high-tech boom. Unemployment had fallen to its lowest level in 30 years. Wages were rising very nicely for low-income, middle-class, and high-income workers. So it was really a very good period. And after 2000, after the high-tech bubble burst after the recession, I really saw this horrible squeeze developing, and it seemed to get worse and worse. And yes, I did, you know, periodically come across these terrible stories of, you know, farm workers who earn so little and have to pay such high rents that they sleep on riverbanks, or Walmart workers who, you know, work the night shift and they're locked in at night. You know, they're told that, you know, they can't go out unless there's a fire. And I actually interviewed workers who, like, broke their ankles, broke fingers, and they weren't able to go to the hospital because they were told you're locked in and you can't go out the fire door. I also wrote a lot about what's happening to the middle class, and I was surprised that there's such a squeeze on, you know, middle class Americans, what's happening with wages. And I also write a good bit about, you know, just how the treatment has gotten worse. You know, there's less job security, and in many ways, workers are treated with a surprising lack of dignity.
Tell me about Michael Johnson.
Michael Johnson is this security guard in Los Angeles. He's been a security guard for 17 years. He has five children. He lives in a, you know, very dark, dank two-bedroom apartment. And, you know, he's a good guy. He wants to do right by his kids. You know, he admits he had bad times. He was, you know, he once did a lot of drugs. He spent a little time in jail, but now he's, you know, literally found religion. So he, you know, to support his kids and to do right by them, he works two full-time jobs. He works one job as a security guard from around, you know, 8 in the morning to 4. And after 17 years, he's making $10 an hour on that job. And that wasn't enough to support his family. So he took a second full-time job also as a security guard where, you know, he works to about 10, 11 at night on that job. So he leaves home at 6 in the morning before his five kids even wake up. And he gets home from work around 11, 11:30 after all his kids have gone to sleep. So here's a guy who's busting his derriere to, you know, support his five kids, yet he doesn't even get to see them during the week. And he says, this is crazy. I'm missing my kids grow up. I can't do this forever.
You say the Johnson story nags you.
Yes, it's... You see people wanting to do the right thing. You know, we've heard about welfare queens and lazy people who don't do enough to, you know, support their families. Here's a guy who's, you know, working harder than any human being would want to work. His wife, Denisha, got very badly injured when she fell lifting a patient at a nursing home, so she can't work. So he's trying to do the right thing by his family, and, you know, he really can't make ends meet. And one of the crazy things, Bob, is when he took the second job, California officials said, well, now you're earning so much, we're going to take you and your family off of food stamps. So he feels, you know, caught in this treadmill where he's running, you know, fantastically fast, but he doesn't seem to be able to move ahead.
And it's not just low-wage employees. You say there's an assault on pensions going on in the country.
We've really seen over the past decades, you know, many of the nation's leading companies move away from pensions. You know, my parents, my father is a teacher and my mother is a social worker, they're retired, they're in their 80s, and they live pretty well on their pensions. You know? And I see that young people going to work now, they're not even really being offered pensions. They're being offered 401ks, which aren't nearly as generous, aren't nearly as reliable. And many companies that offer 401ks, one-fourth of the people don't even sign up for them. A lot of people have no idea how to invest their money. And, you know, the good pensions that, you know, GM and AT&T and IBM were offering, you know, they promised workers that, you know, they'll pay workers, you know, a solid monthly stipend from the time they retire till their death. But 401ks don't come close to doing that. The average person near retirement between age 55 and 64 has a 401k with only $54,000. So imagine retiring at the age, say, 62, and you're going to live another 20, 25 years perhaps, and you only have $54,000 in your 401k. One statistic, Bob, is a generation ago, 70, 80% of workers in companies with more than 100 employees, 70%, 80% of the workers at those companies had those good pensions that promised you, you know, lifetime benefits after you retire. Now only about one-third of workers in those companies with more than 100 employees have pensions, because companies are moving increasingly from regular pensions to 401ks. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, the generation that's retiring now, well, they'll have good pensions generally, but their children and their children's children might actually have a worse time in retirement than people retiring now.
What's the most egregious case of CEO success and plentitude on one end and worker mistreatment on the other?
I write a lot about Walmart. You know, Lee Scott is the, H. Lee Scott Jr. is the CEO of Walmart. And under him, the company has grown very well. And Lee Scott makes, you know, 15, 20, 25 million a year. And many of the workers at Walmart I interviewed complain that they would be forced to work off the clock, meaning you're supposed to clock out the end of your days at 6 o'clock, but then your manager will squeeze you to contribute 1 or 2 hours for free. And I write a lot about a gentleman in Florida who worked at Sam's Club. Sam's Club's owned by Walmart, and he was locked in at night. His name is Farris Cobb. He was a night supervisor. He tells these horrible stories where he was, you know, one forklift driver came in late night after night after night, and Farris said, you know, this has to stop. You're setting a bad example. So the forklift driver pulled a knife on Farris, and, you know, Farris, he was worried that he might be killed, but because they were locked in the store, he could not even run out to safety.
Yeah.
There was a hurricane also, and they were worried that, you know, the roof was going to blow off the store and things would come piling down on them. And they said, we want to leave. We're scared. We worry our lives are threatened. And they were locked in, and the company said you have to stay. And you know, one last thing about Walmart. You know, Walmart in many ways is a wonderful company. It offers good prices. Yet many of the workers complain that the health benefits there are really pretty bad.
And now, wait a minute. They have a handy company fact sheet on their website.
Yes.
Where they tout the average hourly wage for their employees is $10.83. They claim that 92.7% of their associates report having some sort of health insurance, either through the Walmart plan or another source, and that they insure 1.1 million employees and their family members.
Right. Yes, I mean, Walmart is one of the few companies that boasts, you know, the total percentage of its workers who are insured. I mean, the, you know, in ways, the more interesting number is that only about 50%, only about one half of Walmart's employees get their health insurance through the Walmart plan. And that's because many of them are students who rely on their, you know, parents' health plan, or many of them, you know, because the Walmart plan is so bad, will rely on their spouses for their health plan. And, you know, the typical Walmart worker might earn $20,000 a year, yet under several of the Walmart health plans, you know, workers are often called on to pay a deductible of $4,000 a year. And that's a whole lot of money if your income is only $20,000 a year.
You talked to some former managers. Melissa Jenkins is one. What did she tell you?
Melissa is this sweet woman who grew up in the Bible Belt in southern Indiana, and you know, she was ambitious. She became a manager at a Walmart store in Fort Wayne, and she said there was humongous pressure on her and other managers not to exceed the assigned payroll, because they knew that if they exceeded the assigned payroll, their heads could roll, or they could be demoted. So she said she and others, you know, did all sorts of, she'll admit, inappropriate, even illegal things to make sure that she did not exceed payroll. She said there might be a good worker who's been there 15 years making $10, $11 an hour, and they were worried that payroll is getting too high, so they'd want to get rid of that person and replace that person with, a $6 employee. So they might take the $11 an hour person who's been working there for 15 years and reassign that person to unloading trucks at night, which is the worst job in the store. And if you want to get, you know, if you're ever assigned to unloading trucks at night, that means your boss wants to get rid of you. And so many of these older workers who'd been there, you know, 10, 15 years and were being paid a little more would basically be forced to leave. And Melissa told me that, you know, she did all sorts of things to save money. When people were laid off after Christmas because of the Christmas slowdown, in theory, a lot of these workers would be entitled to unemployment insurance because it was a regular layoff. But she said that she and other Walmart managers often went to the state unemployment office and said, these people were fired for egregious misbehavior and do not deserve unemployment insurance. Mm-hmm. Now, I should say, you know, Walmart says that it, you know, has strict orders to its managers always to comply with the law, to do the right thing. And I'll, you know, I give, you know, H. Lee Scott, the CEO, credit. You know, he's been really trying in the past few years to create a more legal, law-abiding, law-complying climate in Walmart. But several managers I've spoken to at Walmart say, well, we're still under such crazy, intense pressure not to exceed payroll. Payrolls that they say are often unrealistically low, that they say they still cut corners, even though they're warned that you can get fired for cutting corners. They say that Walmart sends out two contradictory messages. One, you better comply with the law, you better cut corners. And two, we're signing you this very low payroll to help us maximize profits, and you better not exceed that payroll.
Well, I know they go to great lengths to prevent union organizing.
You know, Walmart has, what, 1.4 million workers now in the United States, and not one of them is unionized. And there was one store in Texas that voted to unionize, where the meat cutters there voted to unionize. And a few weeks later, Walmart announced basically that it's closing all its meat cutting departments in the South. And the union said clearly Walmart was doing that to, you know, shut up the unions, shut down the unions, discourage unions. And Walmart said, no, this was something we were always planning to do as a cost-saving measure. I interviewed this security guard at a Walmart in Texas, and he said that during this unionization drive of the meat cutters down there, he was ordered to sneak into the store after midnight and install all these cameras to spy on the workers. He told me this funny story that he was even ordered to install a camera in like a meat locker, a freezer, a giant freezer. But he said it was very hard to take pictures with the camera because the camera lens kept misting up. This guy, Mike Michelle, was a very good security guard. He, over a two-year period, he, you know, caught, arrested 180 shoplifters. He was kind of a star. And one day, he's summoned by the assistant store manager. He's told that there's someone using kited checks. He runs into the parking lot after this thief, and the thief's accomplice, you know, slams on the accelerator, you know, runs the car into Mike Michelle. Mike, you know, has his kneecap broken. He tears a rotator cuff, and he hurts his back very badly. Miraculously, he's still back at work the next day, and he caught another shoplifter the day after. But when a few weeks later, he told his managers, you know, my knee's killing me, my back's killing me. I need an operation. And they warned him that if he did that, if he filed for a workers' comp claim, he would get demoted to the lowly position of door greeter, which paid less than half of his job. Getting back to Walmart and unions for a second, Bob, I also interviewed a former Walmart store manager in Kentucky, John Lehman, and he told me the story that one day he was in the store's bathroom and there was a pro-union sign in the toilet. And I'm not making this up, Bob. Store managers, store officials are required that as soon as they get the slightest sniff of pro-union sentiment, they have to call Walmart headquarters in Bentonville. So John Lehman obligatorily called, and he said that very afternoon, Walmart dispatched an airplane with three or four human resources, i.e. anti-union officials, to his store to help develop a strategy to keep out the union.
Pretty quick.
They call it the Walmart Air Force.
I'm talking with Stephen Greenhouse about the difficult working conditions many American workers must endure to keep their jobs. Greenhouse is a reporter for the New York Times and author of the book The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker. You write about the company Caterpillar, the world's largest maker of construction equipment, proud to be an American company. What's going on there?
I used to be a reporter in the Midwest, and Caterpillar was really, for a long time, one of my favorite companies. I used to wear a yellow Caterpillar hat. But over the past few years, Caterpillar has adopted this stiff-arming attitude that, you know, many companies and corporate managers have adopted. And they now have this two-tier wage system. And I write about a young man, actually in his late 20s, John Arnold, who makes, you know, $14.90 an hour. That's the maximum he'll ever be able to make because he's part of the second tier that, you know, new workers join. So he works right next to people who were hired before him who are making about 25% more. And in theory, he can never catch up to them. And his father works in the exact same plant, and his father makes 25 an hour, again, because he was part of the top tier, and John will have a hard time ever catching up. And one of the sad things I discovered was that, you know, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, the typical compensation package for manufacturing workers in the Midwest was about $30, $35, maybe $20, $22 an hour in wages and maybe $12 an hour in benefits. And now that whole compensation package is going down from about $35 an hour to about $25 an hour, or even $20 an hour in some places, because many companies are trying to squeeze manufacturing wages that used to be $20 an hour down to $12 and $13 an hour. And that's in ways making things much harder for our kids' generation.
Tell me the story of the woman who was dubbed the Norma Rae of Syracuse.
I got a phone call. I was on vacation one summer day in upstate New York, and I got a phone call from someone from the New York State Labor Religion Coalition, and he said, you know, there's this crazy story up in Syracuse, Steve. You got to go check it out. So I went up to Syracuse a few weeks after I finished vacation, and there's this little plant there called Landis Plastics. And I interviewed, you know, several workers there, and I ended up focusing on one woman named Kathy Samir. And at this little plant that made plastic cups for yogurt, plastic cups for cottage cheese and cream cheese, over one 13-month period, four of the 190 workers had fingers amputated. You know, their fingers got caught in the printing presses or the injection molding machines. And Kathy, who grew up, you know, very poor, her father had left, and two of her siblings were deaf, and, you know, her mother, you know, wasn't earning much, and they lived on welfare. You know, Kathy quit school at the age of 16. She took a job at Catholic Charities. She took another job as a secretary at the local diocese. And, you know, she was struggling to support her family, to help her mom, and she bounced from job to job for a while, and then she decided to go to work at Landis Plastics. And she was frustrated, fed up, astounded, you know, maddened by what was happening at this plant, by the amputations. And of all the, you know, 190 workers there, it was Kathy who really took the lead to try to fight what was happening there. So there were the amputations. There was horrible sexual harassment. You know, a lot of the women I interviewed said that the male workers would, you know, grab butts, grab breasts, and the women were just outraged. And you know, the top 20 jobs on the factory floor were the technical jobs fixing the machinery. You know, 19 of those 20 jobs were held by men. And the lower level jobs were the basic machine tenders, you know, who removed the plastic cups when they came off the machines. 93% of those jobs were held by women. So there was Kathy went to the OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, to complain about the dangerous machine. She went to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission to lodge a complaint about both the sexual harassment and the sexual discrimination. And she was the worker who led the effort to unionize the plant. The United Steelworkers were trying to unionize it. So suddenly, bad things started to befall Kathy. You know, the company said one day, you know, a cop showed up at the plant and called Kathy over and said, there's another worker whose car won't start this morning. She thinks you sabotaged it. And Kathy was sure they were just trying to set her up to fire her. Another day, Kathy was reassigned to what was basically solitary confinement within the plant. You know, she was in this little room all by herself. She couldn't talk to anybody all day. She thought they were trying to drive her out, but she still refused to quit. Finally, one day, you know, Kathy reports to work, goes to pick up a paycheck, and she said, you know, the human resources manager wants to speak to you. And the human resources manager says, I'm sorry to have to tell you this, Kathy, but we're suspending you because you sexually abused two of the male workers. And she says, what? You know, you've been trying to set me up for weeks. This is crazy. You know, how could you accuse me of this? And she was accused of pulling down the pants of two male workers and touching them inappropriately. And, you know, the Steelworkers Union, a whole community, a lot of religious leaders in Syracuse went to bat for Kathy. And, you know, this eventually went before the National Labor Relations Board. And several judges found that, you know, Kathy had been illegally fired on trumped up charges just to retaliate against her because she was the one who was standing up and speaking out to try to stop the abuses at the plant. Hers is an amazing story of a humble woman who faced great difficulties at work, and she really courageously spoke out.
You know, it wasn't always like this. General Motors shared its success with its employees after World War II.
Yes. There was really a golden age for American, for the American economy, for American workers, for American companies after World War II. General Motors, Ford, United States Steel kind of worked arm in arm with the United Auto Workers, the United Steel Workers, and together they formed this great social contract that in turn helped create the world's largest, richest middle class. After the war, you know, through union contracts, through great gains in productivity, you know, these union contracts, you know, gave workers middle-class wages, good health benefits, good pension benefits, and real job security. And, you know, starting in the 70s and 1980s, unfortunately, things, you know, the squeeze really started to develop, and it's gotten worse and worse decade by decade.
Stephen Greenhouse is a labor and workplace issues reporter for the New York Times. We'll talk more after the break. You're listening to Bob Edwards Weekend. Welcome back to Bob Edwards Weekend, produced by XM Satellite Radio and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. I'm talking with reporter Stephen Greenhouse about working life in America. He's interviewed many people whose days at the office last far more than 8 hours without extra pay, but with the added risk of unsafe conditions and limited health insurance. I asked Greenhouse when the status and treatment of the American worker first began to decline.
I date it generally to the 1980s for several reasons. And you know, it's hard to say it was specifically this year or that year. But I think one thing in the 1980s, American industry felt much, much more pressure from imports. You know, in the 70s, there was some pressure, you know, in the apparel industry, in the shoe industry. But in the 80s, we really felt it big time in some extremely important industries like autos and steel and electronics. And so companies realized that, hey, we have to get our costs down. So they really, in the 80s, started treating the workers worse and being more stingy. You know, Ronald Reagan, in ways, led the way when there was the illegal air traffic controller strike in 1981. He did something no president ever did before. He basically, you know, fired the 11,500 strikers, and he, you know, ordered the union out of existence because of the illegal strike, and he replaced them with permanent replacement workers. And, you know, he got the airports up and running again. And many corporate executives across the nation saw how President Reagan was successful in battling unions, and they took a much tougher stance in battling unions after 1981. I think that's another reason that things have gotten worse for workers. Companies have gotten more aggressive, and unions have grown much, much weaker since the 1980s. Unions now represent just 7.5% of the workers in the nation's private sector. That's about a fifth of where it was a half century ago. You know, back in the 1950s, unions were, you know, powerful, and they could really, you know, pressure companies to be more generous and pressure managers, you know, not to be so tough or mean. I think this generation of managers is just much tougher than the generation one or two generations ago. It's almost ingrained in many managers now that, you know, you've got to be tough, that you can't give workers an inch. We have to maximize profits and minimize payroll costs. I think another big shift why companies are tougher is that there's much, much more, Wall Street is placing much, much more pressure on companies than was the case decades ago, much more pressure on companies to maximize their share price, which means maximize your profits, which means trying to minimize your payroll costs. And that, you know, there are now 7-8 million undocumented workers and millions of other immigrant workers in the nation now. And I think one of the reasons managers have gotten meaner is they feel there's this new immigrant workforce that often doesn't speak the language well, that is just easy to push around. And that just, I think, emboldens many managers not just to mistreat immigrant workers, but to start, you know, getting curter and tougher and harsher on American workers as well.
Let's talk about law enforcement. If your boss is at a computer erasing hours from your timesheet, that's not even meanness. That is larceny. He is stealing from you.
Yes. You know, the number of workers in the United States has gone up more than 50% over the past few decades, yet the number of workers in the Federal Wage and Hour Division has actually declined over that period. So we have many more workers, but in ways, not as much workplace enforcement. And I think many managers realize that computers, I'm sad to say, often make it easier for them to cheat. You just go in, you know, the computer is registered that, you know, Johnny has worked from 9 o'clock to 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., saying 12 hours, including 4 hours of overtime. So it's often, you know, just with the click of a mouse, a manager can erase 2 hours. And I think many managers know that the chances of being caught are so low that they see very little reason not to break the law.
Your colleague at the New York Times, Louis Yucatel, wrote a book last year called The Disposable American that went into the myths that are used to justify layoffs. But in his reporting, he found that American workers often blame themselves for their misfortunes, not the companies they work for. Somehow it's their fault if they had just worked harder or whatever. Do you find any of that?
Yeah, I found some of that. Anytime you get laid off, and this has happened to friends of mine, you think, well, gee, I must have done something wrong. It's my fault that I was laid off and not the person next door. But I think a lot of people realize that, you know, maybe companies, you know, don't have to lay off so many people. And I think too often managers just reflexively feel, well, we got to cut costs. We want to get our share price up. Let's lay off some people. That will impress shareholders. Clearly, some workers don't do a good enough job, and then they get laid off. But I think some workers are doing perfectly well, you know, going above and beyond, and they still get laid off. I write about this Westinghouse worker who saw several waves of downsizing where she worked. So she busted her butt. She, you know, and she worked 70, 80 hours a week. She was going to show them that, you know, no one works better, no one works harder than her, and that if you're going to lay off anyone, she should be the last one you ever get laid off. Yet, Westinghouse laid her off too, even after it had returned to profitability. And sometimes it's very hard to know why this person gets laid off rather than that person. You know, sometimes it might be because, you know, the person who remained was a favorite of the boss. I generally don't recommend that employees blame themselves when they're laid off, when there are waves of downsizing.
Just interviewed columnist David Serrata, who believes this feeling is manifesting itself in politics now, that there is this populism, both on the left and the right, in which people are getting very angry and leading movements that are political.
I agree, Bob. For too many years, politicians in Washington, on both sides of Pennsylvania Avenue, Congress and the White House, were paying very, very little attention to worker issues. And that the only time politicians seemed to discover workers and their problems was every leap year, every fourth year, when presidential candidates were campaigning in Iowa, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. And, you know, unfortunately, I might be right about that again this year. You know, suddenly worker issues are in the news, and that's good. One thing that interested me is, you know, there was a period in 2000 when Al Gore was running for president, and he used populist rhetoric for a day or two. And everyone came down on him saying, he's a class warrior, this is terrible. And then Gore shut up. And the same thing happened with Kerry in 2004. Remember, he talked about offshoring and Benedict Arnold companies that were moving jobs overseas, and then he got banged over the head for being a class warrior. And, you know, so he, you know, was quiet, you know, he shut up about that. And now Obama's using some populist rhetoric, and no one's saying, oh, this is terrible, this is class warfare. I think, you know, the news media and even the Republicans see that, you know, the working class voters have been really hit very hard over the past few years, and that the populist message really is resonating. You know, we've seen these polls showing that, 81-84% of American workers think something is seriously off track. You know, I often ask people, who said this? Was it, you know, Jesse Jackson, Ralph Nader, or John Edwards? And the quote is, the average American went exactly nowhere on the economic scale since the 1980s. He's been on a treadmill while the super rich have been on a spaceship. Who said that? Not Ralph Nader, not Jesse Jackson. It was Warren Buffett, who's now the nation's richest man. And Buffett also said, there's class warfare, all right, but it's my class, the rich class, that's making war, and we're winning. And, you know, Buffett is, you know, is like considered, you know, the nation's best umpire. He calls things the way they are. And even if he is saying that, you know, that there's a real squeeze on the middle class and on people on the bottom, I think it shows something serious is going on here. And even Warren Buffett is, in ways, speaking out in populist ways. And I think there's a real sentiment, a real dismay, disgruntlement, even anger among workers that, you know, they are feeling themselves squeezed. You know, as we said, Bob, you know, wages for the average worker have gone nowhere since 2001. You know, there's this crazy statistic that for the typical American household, the median income since 2000 is down $2,375, almost, you know, $2,400 for the average household. That's scary, and that was before the recent increases in fuel costs and food costs. So to me, Bob, it's not surprising that there's this populist sentiment bubbling up. People are upset that their wages are going nowhere when, you know, CEOs are making, you know, 400 times what the average worker makes, when the Exxons and the oil companies are making these humongous profits.
And they fail and get bonuses.
Yes, they do.
Golden parachutes.
Yeah. Some of the bonuses are just amazing. You know, the former chairman of Exxon stepped down with, I think, 200 or 300 million as a farewell package. The head of Pfizer.
Well, they got record profits, though.
Well, they have record profits. You know, the former head of Pfizer, who was basically pushed out, he left with I might be off by 10 million, you know, maybe $100 million package, even though under him, you know, Pfizer's share price dropped by about 40%. And, you know, for reasons that defy logic, you know, these corporate boards throw money at these people, even if they perform very poorly. And you think we're a meritocracy, and that if someone does a lousy job, you don't, you know, shower them with tens of millions of dollars.
Stephen Greenhouse is the author of The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker. He writes about labor and workplace issues for the New York Times.